Welcome to another episode of Zealous Podcast. I'm Rocky Snyder. This week, I get Nick Winkelman on the show. Now, Nick is the author of The Language of Coaching, The Art and Science of Teaching Movement. So we're definitely going to talk a whole bunch about coaching. Because right now, he has been the head of athletic performance and science for the Irish Rugby Football Union. And prior to that, he oversaw the speed and assessment component of the Exos NFL Combine Development Program. He's worked with athletes in the NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, a whole bunch of national sports organizations, not to mention the military. And Nick's over in the UK right now, working with the Irish rugby teams, and we're just going to talk all about how to be an effective coach. Remember to subscribe and tell others about these episodes, and follow us on Instagram while you're at it, Rocky_Snyder. Hope you enjoy the show.
It's funny, Nick, you and I have a couple of things in common, aside from being strength conditioning coaches and whatnot. We both wrote books and released them right at the beginning of COVID. So our timing is brilliant, brother. I just can't get over it. But I want to talk about your book, The Language of Coaching and The Art and Science of Teaching Movement, right? Isn't that the subtitle?
That is. You nailed it.
Yeah. So this is obviously a culmination of years of your professional and personal experience, but what inspired you, first of all, to sit down and start typing up some notes and writing a book?
Yeah, so you know what? This book is a long time in the making. I guess most books are for people, but for me, it has to go back to a moment in college, and I wrote about this in the book, where I was watching the gentleman I was following at the time I was interning out there, watching him coach, and I was just trying to understand why he appeared to be so superior to some of the other coaches that I was watching and following at the time. And this was just in a personal training context. And what I recognize is, well, geez, from a program design perspective, you know, he's benching everybody on Monday. They're always doing biceps and triceps at the end of the workout. You know, squatting maybe happens every other week. And so, you know, joking aside, his programming was good, but it was really no different to anybody else. If you had read, you know, Bompa or Sif and Verkashansky, you know, Poliquin, it was all there. But he still had something different, a bit of an X factor. And inevitably, I realized a lot of it came down to the moment before the movement. He was artful in his ability to give one idea, one singular cue to help them get the most out of the movement. And as an aside, he did a lot of work with amateur bodybuilders. And so they were always trying to, I just watched, you know, Pump and Iron, get the pump, you know, as Arnold would say. And so they were always trying to get the pump. And he would just come up with some of the most creative, highly visual coaching cues that seemed just unavoidably easy to apply. And the amount of times his clients would just come out of the lift, eyes wide open, light bulb on, like, yes, I finally am feeling it. I get it. I was just in awe at this skill. And what was interesting is when I would ask him, hey, what's your super strength? What do you think you're really good at? He'd say, oh, my understanding of anatomy and program design and specific range of motion, right? All of the what, but made no mention of the how, no mention of the coaching. And so I logged this. I must have been 20 at the time. And I remember telling another mentor around the same period, listen, what this guy is doing is unreal. I feel a real connection with it. I don't know why. I got to write a book on this one day called, and at the time I called it The Form Within, kind of thinking that related to how we think while we move. And, you know, fast forward almost 10 years after that, maybe a little bit less, I found myself leading the NFL Combine Development Program at Exos, having 8 weeks to prepare these, you know, highly recruited young men to go show off everything they can physically at the NFL Combine. You know, they were putting pressure on themselves, on us, parents, agents. And so it was a high risk, high reward environment. And so it was the crucible of that pressure that summoned these ideas again. And when I recognized that the program that I was running at Exos was highly developed. I mean, there were a multitude of now NFL strength coaches who had written the program that I had now adopted. And so what I saw as the next level of progression was not so much emphasizing what to do, but how we did it. And seeing that I might have 30 athletes and all of them needed me to say things in a slightly different way to achieve the same ultimate outcome of moving faster in all planes of motion. And that brought me back face to face on this path of studying the intersection between what we say, our coaching cues notably, and how it impacts focus in the athlete, and ultimately how focus relates to immediate performance and learning. And so, you know, fast forward now, the journey's over 15 years since I've really started to study this. And in, you know, 2020, like yourself, The Language of Coaching, albeit not The Form Within, but the same principle book, The Language of Coaching, was born. And it was the book I wish I had. It was the book that elevates how we coach to the same discussion, to the seat at the table as what we coach.
So your mentor was basically, in a nutshell, saying less is more. You know, one cue, one thing to inspire change or focus or development. Do you still hold true to that? Like, do you still try and find that one nugget to share, to just have them kind of focus on that?
Rocky, 100%. For me, it is the overwhelming principle. It is the starting point. It's the ticket to the start line for effective coaching, in that many well-intentioned coaches have screwed up athletes and clients because of a desire, a thirst to teach. And they overemphasizing teaching at the expense of recognizing what they're really there for, and that is to help the athlete learn something. And so we run into these attentional bottlenecks all the time, where we give so much information and the athlete will look at us and say, so what do you want me to do? But in many cases, the athletes are too shy or scared to do that, so they say nothing at all. But ultimately what's going on in their head is utter confusion or simply dismissal at the recognition that, hey, I don't know what coach said, or I don't know what of the 10 things he or she just said I should be focusing on. And so they continue despite the coach, not because of the coach. And I use this anecdote, metaphor, when it comes to providing too many coaching cues. And it goes something like this. It's as if you were to take breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's like giving three coaching cues. It's as if I'm taking breakfast, lunch, and dinner, putting it in a blender, pouring it into a glass, handing it to you, Rocky, and say, hey, take a sip and tell me which meal you like the most, right? That's what we do. That's what we do when we overcoach. We water down the specific, turn it into something general without specificity, without taste, without nuance when we overcoach, because there is limitations to how much information we can take in, let alone how much we can think about while we're actually performing a movement. And so I live by the one cue, one rep, and it's never steered me or the athlete in the wrong.
Okay, so let's take that in effect into, say, just a traditional lift that it's just common, like the squat. Let's just take the squat, for instance, right? And of course, we know there's 206 bones, 630 plus muscles, encapsulating everything there, and you're moving through three-dimensional space. It's so easy to get into the complexity of it. If where's the pressure, where's the lift, what's your spine and your shin angle and all those things, which you hear over and over. How would you coach an individual in the squat? And I know that everyone's going to be slightly different and we can talk about that in a minute, but what is your cue?
So before I answer that, let me answer a question before that, because you point to some really important things that a coach may want to get across to an athlete, right? You've talked about, you know, specific joints or joint positions, specific actions. You know, they could be thinking about something in the lower limb versus the upper limb. And a listener who's never come into contact with this information, just from what they've heard so far, You want to take that complex of a lift and say, I can only say one thing? Come on, get off it. So let's take a step back. When it comes to coaching, I believe coaching in a lot of ways is like programming. There is an optimization in the order you do things in programming to get the most out of one's physiology. We know traditionally in a program, if you're going to do a concurrent program on any given day, you're probably going to do your power work first, then any strength work you have, and then any more endurance volume-based work towards the end, right? You wouldn't do an entire Olympic lifting session, you know, after you've just run a marathon. So there's a physiological order of operations that we all respect when it comes to program design so that we do not have physiological competition. The exact same thing holds when it comes to offering information, cognitively stored information meant to influence a movement. And so to keep it dead simple, that information can be broken into two broad categories, okay, when it comes to teaching movement. And so I want everyone listening to recognize that communication, we're talking about communication generally. Communication applies to a lot of different things. What you and I are discussing in this moment, Rocky, is movement communication, how we communicate movement in a way so that the athlete can understand, action it, and move better. So let's be clear. And so when it comes to movement communication, there are two major categories of information a coach might want to get across, okay? Category number one is the knowledge of what to do. You want to categorically provide them with knowledge of what they're going to do. But then here's the one that we oftentimes miss inadvertently. We also want to provide them with knowledge of how to do it. Now, let me insert an anecdote that any coach who's coached for any length of time will have come across. And that is the athlete that says, Coach, I know what to do. I just don't know how to do it. They can watch video of themselves. They can watch video of others. They can even tell you verbatim based on how their body feels what needs to change. And the coach agrees to the dotted I and the crossed T, but the athlete can't bring it into real life. They can't act it out in their movement. And so that's where, for me, when I see that, assuming there's no underpinning physical problem, physical handbrake, if you will, that tells me we haven't delivered the knowledge of how. We haven't given them a coaching cue that brings the oneness. This is a key term I like to use. We haven't given them a key coaching cue that brings the oneness of the movement into form, because otherwise they'd be doing it. So the next question people might be thinking is, okay, zoom into that. What is the stuff that we're saying when we say knowledge of what? What's the stuff when we say the knowledge of how? And so for anyone that picks up the book, I talk about this idea of a coaching communication loop. You may have seen this yourself, Rocky. And I talk about three things need to happen when you're teaching a movement for the first time. You're going to describe it, you're going to demonstrate it, and you're going to cue it. So when you describe a movement, that's conventionally called instructing, right? Description, instruction, they're synonyms here. This is where I'm saying, Rocky, we're going to do this squat. Okay, I want you to watch me. I'm going to show you how to set up. So you set up your feet, you get under the bar, you show the grip, right? You're walking them through this narrative style, step by step. Show them how to get out, and then you perform a couple repetitions. Now, what this has done is this is like the blender. It's given them a general understanding of what needs to happen. But there is nothing in what you've outlined that stands out. You have not flagged any one thing in that long narrative that needs to be the guiding light. So okay. Here's what I want coaches to think about. Normally, that's where our coaching begins and ends. We just coach in terms of steps. Hey, this goes here, that goes there. Your butt needs to go back. Your knees need to go out. Your chest needs to be up. You got to go faster. But ultimately, when I say your hips need to go back, that is isolating the macro into the micro. It's an artificial cue. It's highlighting a step that's amongst many steps. And it becomes very difficult to just think about the hips and really isolate just the hips when I'm doing a multi-joint movement, which is why usually those cues fail, at least in the long term. And so what that tells us is we need then a piece of information that can tie all that together. And this is where the cue comes in. The cue is like a pair of glasses. You only wear one of them. A cue is like an address in a GPS. You only input one of them. A cue is like the conductor in a symphony. You only need one of them. And in all of those cases, they get us to the desired destination. They improve our clarity, and they can coordinate a multitude of muscles and joints to create oneness, as in song for a symphony or as in movement for the body. And so this is where it comes down to the KPI, the key performance inhibitor, or the priority. And so, Rocky, if I'm coaching you in the squat, the first coaching cue I'm going to use is to zip my mouth. I'm going to give you the lightest description of what needs to happen. I'm going to leverage heavily demonstration, because when you watch a demonstration, your visual system can pick up the rhythm, the pattern, and imprint it and act as if, mirror you. And I'm going to say, go have a go. And I'm going to watch you squat. It might be one set, two sets, three sets, but I'm going to watch you squat enough until I get Rocky's squatting signature. And so let's say for you, consistently, you're not getting your hips back. You want a little bit more loading of the hips. That's what I've identified as the primary error. Now, mind you, as a footnote to this, I would have already done some level of assessment to know your mobility, your stability, to make sure there's no underpinning physical handbrake. I want everyone listening to recognize that. You can't fix a mechanical problem with a technical cue. So you and I are talking about sharing sound waves, sharing words. Okay, my words, albeit quite powerful, as are yours, they can't fix a faulty hip. Some things need to be dealt with, right, with physical movement and grooving. But sure, let's assume that's not the issue. It's truly a patterning problem. We need the hips to get back. And so now I don't have to cue the 100 things that could possibly go wrong. I've got to cue the one. And so for me, I might simply say, hey, I want you to imagine there's a bench below you. I might even put a bench below you. And I want you to reach out as if you're going to tap it. Or let's say I want to impart a little bit of control. And I'm going to ask you, I'd say, hey, Rocky, are you going to sit down on a soft bed the same way you're going to sit down on a rackety old bench? And what do you say?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No.
So I say, hey, when you're loading back and sitting down, this ain't a comfy coach. I want you to load down with that control and hesitation as if you're sitting down on an old creaky bench. So see what I've done there. In both cases, it's one cue, but the sense of the creaky bench that could break, that might not hold you, slows you down. You push your hips back more to kind of test the proverbial waters, and that still creates this oneness in the totality of the movement. In both cases, we're using a cue that falls in the form of an analogy. And so to put a bit of summary here, the knowledge of what is typically how we coach. We just tell them what to do. We give them step-by-step instructions that tend to be very internally oriented, right? But that only elevates their conceptual knowledge of what to do, their intellectual ability to talk about the movement. But in the game of show and tell, it's not just called tell, is it? It's called show and tell. And so what that means is we need the ability to verbalize and the ability to demonstrate. And that's where the knowledge of how comes in. That's where the coaching cue, the moment before the movement, comes in. And here we can start to get into specifics of the methodology, but here's where we want to provide cues that bring oneness. These fall into external cues that target something in the environment, or analogies, as we demonstrated with the creaky bench versus the comfortable bed. Inevitably, we have to dance with the athlete. We have to work with them to see what works, but I'm walking you through the thought process by which that takes form. The key thing, though, is in the execution, and we can get into that with any follow-up questions, but that's my starting point to answering that question. It's laying out the anatomy of the communication we need to use, and it's bringing in that new piece, the knowledge of how the cue, which is very external in its orientation or analogy, very visual, easy to apply in the oneness. It doesn't break the body into parts. It respects movement as the whole.
Yeah, so it's a lot of imagery and tapped in with experiential knowledge of the past, right?
That's, bingo.
So we're creating an environment within their mind that their body is going to have to physically respond based on that image that you've just set forth, whether it's you are in a very narrow alley and your body is almost touching the wall in front of you and the wall behind you, and I need you to move without touching that wall. So now we're going to get a lot of clean lateral motion, at least hopefully, or loading forward. You're standing on a bathroom scale, and I want to see that number slowly increase, and then I want you to back off till it comes to zero. So now, you know, they're getting that sense of, okay, I need to apply more and more force or weight or pressure down through my leg, and then I've got to experience getting off it. So that those are the cues you're kind of talking about.
You're 100%. And I want to build on something you said there. Both cases, your wall example, you're giving yourself the ability to be a world builder, right? When you listen to authors, fictional authors, they talk about this idea of world building. And when they say world building, it's literally how when they write the narrative of the fiction, they write in such a way where your mind starts to literally, from the words on the page, build a visual world in your mind. All the people that read the Harry Potter books, way before the movie, already had a picture of what Harry Potter and Hermione and Dumbledore and all the various aspects and any other fiction they love. They have this image. That's exactly what you're doing there. As you're saying wall in front, it's like the Matrix, right? Uploading Neo to Kung Fu. Bam, I see the wall. I see the back wall. But what you can then do is you can manipulate it as a coach. And I can say, hey, that hallway just got narrower. So I can build that story. Or hey, the hallway got wider. Or hey, the number on the scale didn't go high enough on that rep. And so now what I've done is we both get to step into that story. And I, as the narrator, and them as the protagonist, the main character in that story, we can play and we can interact with that narrative in a visual, memorable, but here's the word, actionable level. People listening to the examples you just gave are the ones I gave. And I get this at times, and I don't mean this to be critical, but they can trivialize it. They can believe that what we're talking about is good for youth, good for kids, but no, not for the elite, the adults. And I would say to the contrary, the more, you said it yourself, Rocky, the more experiences the person has, the more memories and lived outcomes that they've already sampled in the past, the more raw material we have to build these worlds, these visuals via analogy in the future. And so for me, I would say, 8 out of 10 things I say to athletes inevitably fall into this analogy world building category, and they work brilliantly.
So I'm curious too, with this approach must come, you know, observation of their execution of movement, and then you give them a cue and you observe the change. Do you then, I will say, interview or ask them, what does that feel like? Or is that different than before? Or do you do something where they have to internalize or recognize that, okay, that was very different from what I just did? Do you do things like that?
Oh, 100%. So there are many pathways to answering this question, because there's many strategies to bring what you've just pointed to alive. So if I go back to what we said earlier, on the coaching communication loop. So before they ever move, we kind of have this, we describe it, we demonstrate it, we cue it. That's kind of like you do your power, then your strength, then your endurance. There's an order of communication to optimize how they take it on board, respecting the bottleneck. Then they perform the movement. And as you and I already alluded to, we may have them do a number of sets and reps before we even cue for the first time. But once we do finally air a cue, we may want to run with that for a number of further sets until we see whether or not it's jiving, whether or not it's echoing through their movement. But inevitably, we have to get to a point where we involve them in that review. Certainly, it's important that when I watch you move, do you appear to me to move better? If so, that's at least partial evidence that the cue is working. But that also could be by pure chance. Or you might have actually modified the cue yourself. And unless I know that, I don't have a red thread to keep continuity moving forward. And so in the model, after we cue it, they do it. That's the movement. And then the final piece, which you may be pointing to here, is the debrief. And so for me, I use the debrief synonymously with feedback. And so certainly we may give an athlete feedback. Hey, you did this, you did that. This was the outcome. This wasn't the outcome. That's all well and good. But here, when I use the term debrief, it's the part of feedback. It's the portion of feedback where we are discussing the efficacy of the cue. We're discussing how it landed, how it felt. Did they experience the improvement or the lack thereof that I observed? And so with a debrief, D is for discussion. D is for dialogue. It's not an M, it's not a monologue. And so even for a new athlete, I think it's important that we do that. Again, it doesn't mean you have to do it after every set or rep, because that can start to chop up a session and make it clunky, but you need to have these at certain time points where you've reached a critical mass of evidence and said, now I want to check in with this person. And so for me, the debrief is meant to action one of three findings. Either that A, I'm going to repeat the cue because it's working, they like it, and it's making a difference. B, I'm going to refine it, meaning the meaning behind the cue, such as in a sprint, push the ground away, better extension. The meaning was fine, but it didn't carry the potency. It didn't carry the punch. It wasn't the high enough dose for them. And so instead of saying push the ground away, I might say explode off the ground. A simple shifting of the verb in the preposition. And now for some people, and I talk about this in the book, that's enough to make the switch. And so in that case, we're refining the cue. The third possibility, C here, is we retire the cue altogether. We retire the cue because it backfired, it didn't work, or because its potency has waned, right? It's like the wah, wah, wah and the peanuts. They've heard it so many times, it's lost its meaning. And in that case, I possibly have to do a little bit of tinkering. I got to refine it once again. And so utilizing that 3R strategy within a debrief, it then feeds back to the beginning of the loop. And that's why if people can imagine, the five steps I've outlined is the long loop. But once they're familiar with the movement, I don't have to describe and demonstrate over and over again. So then we just get to the short loop. Cue, do, debrief. Cue, do, debrief. And so that debrief, like a feedback loop, upgrades what happens in that moment before the movement, upgrades the cue. And that's the dance. That's the dance. That's the dialogue between me and the athlete and their movement. And the final thing I'll say here, and there's plenty of strategies we could unpack. We have to remember as coaches, we naturally speak as humans. We naturally speak from our own place of truth and understanding. What comes out of our mouth unavoidably makes sense to us. Otherwise, we wouldn't utter it. What we have to learn to do is recognize we are trying to speak the athlete's language. We are trying to speak from their authentic source of truth. And the best way to do that is to invite them into the discussion around cue creation. And so if I can just extend this one step further with an example, I can use the debrief, but sometimes it's better to get them on the upfront. Prospectively rather than retrospectively. And so I might say, Rocky, on your next rep, I want you to focus on pushing the ground away. And we're teaching sprinting here, let's say. And I might give you a couple questions. What does that cue mean to you? Or I might say, how does that cue make you feel? Or I might say, hey, put that cue in your own words if the way I have phrased it doesn't land with you. And so see what I've done there in all three of those ways of fundamentally getting to the same thing. I've involved you in the conversation. I check for your understanding. I check for your listening. I've doubled down on the importance that this is the passenger in your car while you're moving. These are the headlights. This is the glasses you're wearing to move better. And I make sure you're as invested in getting it right as I am, because you're the one that's going to need to think it and you're the one that's going to need to do it. And so that's another example of engaging, or what I like to call co-creating cues. And so if 8 out of 10 things I say are analogies, the vast majority of those are born out of a discussion rather than me just pulling them out of the sky, especially as I work with someone longer over time.
Well, and then there's a level of trust within yourself that of your instinct, shall we say, that yeah. What it is that you're seeing is going to match up in your your mind with what it is you have to get across. Meaning like Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, takes information from our unconscious that is constantly recorded and tries to get some message to our conscious mind. And that is in the form of like what we would call instinct. But really, your years and years of coaching experience of what has worked and what hasn't gives you this Rolodex of unconscious cues to bring forth, hopefully into a conscious kind of verbal analogy, imagery, whatever you'd like to call it. So I guess what I'm also saying to the coaching staff that's listening too, is that we've got to trust our instincts to some degree and know that, okay, this, what I'm seeing here just isn't matching up. I can't maybe put my finger on it right now, but here's what I'm going to try. Would you agree?
I would agree completely. And this is where put your athlete's instincts to work. You can help facilitate them identifying the language or the phrasing that you are armed with your knowledge can, that's all you need to say, okay, now I know. So for example, I might say to you to stick with our sprinting example, Rocky, you're not getting the push off the track or off the field we want. You're leaving money on the table. If we can get you exploding and pushing off that ground with a bit more oomph and energy, we're going to get that speed up. What do you think you can focus on this next repetition to get that job done? And see, what I've done is I didn't just say, hey, what do you think you can focus on? Because that's too much. That's overload, right? They don't know where to. But now what I've placed their attention on one specific tangible feature, relatable feature of this movement. I've outlined it. They're experienced enough to understand the knowledge of what I've just said. And now I'm facilitating them self-identifying how to change it. And what that'll do is that'll at least get the discussion going. And as they start to talk, I'm listening intently to their word choice, their examples, any imagery they use, any verbs, action words they use, because if they can't come up with an idea, usually they'll say enough where they've given me a peek behind the curtain. And now I can see how they're processing this thing we're trying to do. And sometimes that's all I need to then take a few words they've said, I can bake them into a new cue. And it's bespoke right for that person. And that's the beauty of it. But you won't know what will and will not work unless you involve them in the process. And I would imagine a lot of the coaches listening may work in groups and say, well, how do you do that in a group? Well, at a group level, this is where you have to, the longer you do this, the more you're going to get good at predicting cues that kind of generally work for everybody. And that's what I call global cues when I'm coaching a big group of individuals. And for people that don't know my background, I've never worked with individuals. I've always worked in American football and now rugby. So I have no less than 10 plus people. And I'm the one talking about these individualized cues. And so the cool thing is not all 10 people, 20 people in your session are going to need you to the same degree. And so if you set up your session in such a way where there's natural, you know, self-directed work or breaks, you can weave down that line and go into those 2 to 3 specific individuals each day that need a bit more help. And we're talking about once you get good at this, it's a 15 to 30 second conversation, if that. And that can be a quick collaboration. And if needs be, I catch them after the session and I parlay the benefit into the next one. Because nothing's going to be built overnight, but it's about a process that you continue to groove. But it's a process that's committed to the how, not just the what.
Yeah. I love it that we're not talking about specificity of movements. We're not talking about a whole bunch of different, I would say, for lack of a better term, coaching approaches of again, specificity. And for each movement, this is what we want to see. Here are the top 3 things that I want to see in every lift and so on. We're talking about the methodology and the concepts behind trying to take as much information of interviewing an athlete mind as well as interviewing their body. And then can I just boil it down to its most simplest form and get that across to create change?
Love it.
Right?
Yeah. Rocky, I love your articulation of these ideas. Love it. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Okay. So side note, going from American football, taking coaching aside, well, I will keep coaching a little bit, but now you're into like the grandmother of American football. You're into rugby right now. And culturally, in terms of coaching, is there something that you have to dial a little different frequency to so that your players are starting to understand exactly what it is you're getting across? What is this learning curve for you going from one sport to the other?
You know what? It's interesting. I started writing The Language of Coaching in 2016, the year I moved here. And I can tell you right now, Rocky, I don't think the book would be as impactful as I think it is and as the feedback I receive on it had I not made that move, because it forced me as the person committed to stewarding the dissemination of these topics, it forced me to have to deal with them face to face, stepping into an environment where my communication toolkit needed to be, let's say, rejigged, because the English they speak in Ireland and the UK is not the English that we speak in the United States. And even for coaches in the United States that have worked in, you know, the South versus the Northwest versus California, Chicago, New York, or Boston, even in all of those various areas, people have their own slang, right? Their own vernacular, their own kind of colloquial statements that are germane to that area, even within our own country. And so it tested me, but fortunately, the skill set I had developed around learning how to adapt language to the individual and the movements they are performing did not steer me wrong. Fortunately, the movements were the movements. So that was the easy part. Being able to identify what needed to change and the key priority, that was still all there. That stood with me. But just to give a little bit of a funny anecdote for people that haven't spent any time in Ireland or the UK, you know, what we call boots in America, right? The thing you wear when you go hiking, that's what they call the trunk of a car, but also what you wear on your foot when you play any team sport on grass. You know, what we call a field, they call a pitch. What we call chips, they call crisps. What we call fries, they call chips. And so all of the anecdotes that would just use everyday objects and experiences to draw about visual reference, as you and I talked about earlier, the vast majority of them came under the guise of a different name, a different phrase, a different reference, many of which I had no intuitive attachment or knowledge of. And so guess what? It required that I depend early on without ego far more on my athletes, where I would identify what we wanted to change. I'd explain it and how I might phrase it in a fun way in English, in my version of English. Then I'd say, does this compute? Does this land? I always knew when it did, because they would say, yep, that works. And I always knew when it did, because they'd be laughing. They're like, what the heck does that mean? And so we'd have a little bit of a back and forth, and inevitably I'd get the Irishified version of what I was saying. And after a few years, I was able to speak Irish, so Irish English. And I think the athletes enjoyed the humility. They enjoyed the journey. And the byproduct was it continued to refine my ability to ask questions. It reinforced how beneficial it is to derive a cue from a collaboration. And it also allowed me to learn from them all the while, which had I led with ego and feeling like, well, they're just going to expect me to know this and force everything, I wouldn't have achieved the outcome I wanted. And so I think I was able to bring so much of that knowledge, which I had, but hadn't been put to the test, into the book. And so 100%. And what it comes down to is people like to learn new things in terms of things they're already familiar with. And so if you want to coach someone, you need to know them, because that's the only way to know what they're familiar with, what their preferences are, the lens with which they see and act in the world. And that's what I did.
That's fantastic. Nick, I can't thank you enough. This has been a great conversation, great advice in regards to coaching. It was more than I was anticipating. So it was great to go beyond expectations. I appreciate that. And thank you for it. If we're going to get a copy of The Language of Coaching, obviously we can go to online booksellers, but what about your own website? Where can we pick up a copy?
Yeah. So Amazon or Human Kinetics are the two places to get it most readily. In terms of more information, if people want to learn a bit more before they buy in, or even if they buy the book, want to actually go through some video tutorials chapter by chapter, all open source on thelanguageofcoaching.com, which links to all the webinars I've done on YouTube. If people have questions, I answer the email at info@thelanguageofcoaching.com. And kind of the fresh ideas are coming out at Nick Winkelman on the various channels. And what's interesting, Rocky, I just made a notice yesterday. I just started a new book, started writing literally 2 days ago, that will be a fictionalized version of the concepts in the language of coaching. So it'll be a fictional story that portrays all the principles in a narrative story form, just to provide an even more accessible way, I'd like to say, to experience the ideas, not just read about them.
Oh, what a great challenge for you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I've already started. I'm very happy with where it's going. And I should be able to pump it out before the end of the year, I hope. So
you got a working title right now?
I don't. I will say it's going to take place in the Viking era between 800 and 900 Common Era.
Well, you got the beard. It's working for you. You're already there.
We got it. I do a bit of axe throwing. I got the beard. And saying Valhalla is always a great way to get pumped up for your next set.
Well, when it hits the shelves, I definitely want to have you back. We could chat about that as well. But thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for the Zealous Podcast this week. It seemed like it just flew by. I'm sure it did for you too. Be sure to subscribe and check out next week when we have another amazing guest just like Nick. Thanks for listening.